Welcome back to Behind the Bars podcast. This week, we explore the case of David Berkowitz, who's also known as the Son of Sam. David is an American serial killer who murdered six people in New York City in 1976 to 1977. He's responsible for plunging the city into a panic and unleashing one of the largest manhunts in New York City history.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Behind the Bars podcast. As always, I'm McKenna, and we have... Nope, I'm going to start that again. I don't know my name. Who am I? Who are you? Nope. Start again. Do not leave this in. I'll be so
mad. Oh, I'm leaving that in.
No! No, seriously. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Behind the Bars podcast. I'm McKenna. This is DB.
Hello, hello.
Today, we're covering Son of Sam.
Who is probably the most boring serial killer you'll hear about.
For real.
He just, he was boring. All he ever really did was shoot people and stab people. I mean, he didn't eat people or torture people, or which sounds absolutely terrible coming from us, but.
Yes and no, but like as serial killers go, he's kind of lame. And what's funny is like DB and I were both so excited. We were like, yeah, let's do Son of Sam. And then we started reading and we were like, does it get better? And then it didn't get better. It got more boring and kind of more convoluted and just, so.
He's awful. And not a good awful.
Not in like a fun, ooh, what a creepy serial killer awful. Like I said to DB before we started, like he's no worse than any of like the run of the mill, like active shooters that we have running around America right now. So I don't understand why this man gets the infamy that he does.
Because of the time. That's the only reason he got it.
And he has a fun nickname.
Yeah.
Son of Sam just sounds like so cool.
So, Son of Sam, he was born as Richard David Falco on June 1st, 1953, which actually puts him at 67 years old. So he's, for a serial killer, he's pretty young. Most of them are 70s, 80s, 90s, or dead. He was born in Brooklyn, New York. He has two names, one of which is obviously Son of Sam. The second one is the 44 caliber killer due to that being the weapon he used. He used a 44 caliber bulldog pistol, well, revolver, and like she said, would just walk up and shoot the people. He attended two colleges, the Bronx Community College and Sullivan Community College. His convictions were second degree murder and attempted second degree murder because one guy he actually shot in the head and the guy drove away and lived. But we'll get into that one later. Is currently serving six life sentences in New York. His last ability to get out on parole was in 2020, or 2019, one of the two, but it was pushed off.
2019, and then his next one got canceled.
Yeah, it was pushed off, and it's still postponed until further notice due to the COVID epidemic. Oh, where are we at here? All right, victims. He killed six different people and wounded 10, which... eight of them were gunshots, two of them were stabbings. Span of crimes was from July 29th, 1976 to July 31st of 1977. So hardly over a year, which is a very, very short time for a serial killer. Usually it's decades. Like we said, he was in New York. He used a 44 caliber bulldog revolver. They caught him on August 10th, 1977. So just over... a year from when he started, and he's currently imprisoned at the I don't even know how to say it, to be honest.
Oh, hold on.
Joanna Gunk Correctional Facility. New York has these really
hard words in this one.
Yeah. New York has really, really bizarre names for all their prisons for some reason. Mainly because it's New York and it's, you know, I mean, like Yonkers. Who the hell names something Yonkers?
Hey, don't make me launch into Hello Dolly. All right. Let's go back to the very beginning. So, born in 1953, his mother was Elizabeth Betty Broder, the child of an impoverished family. She was a waitress, married Tony Falco, an Italian-American, in 1936. After less than 4 years, Tony up and left her for another woman. So, in 1950, Betty started a relationship with a man, a married man, by the name of Joseph Kleinman. 3 years later, became pregnant with a child who she chose to give the surname Falco, which I find so bizarre that she's going to name her son after the man that left her that she hasn't been with for 4 years.
Yeah.
So that's weird. Within a few days of Richard's birth, Betty gives him away. And they don't really know why, but a lot of people think that Kleinman threatened to abandon her if she kept the baby and used his name. So either way, Berkowitz was given to Pearl and Nathan Berkowitz, a Jewish American family who were hardware store retailers of modest means. And so his birth name was Richard David Falco. They rearranged his name and made it David Richard Berkowitz, and he was their only child. Somewhat troubled childhood, above average intelligence, but then as most intelligent kids do, they either really excel or they get bored and start setting shit on fire. He was the latter. So petty larceny and starting fires, and neighbors and relatives called him difficult, spoiled, and a bully.
I know sources, we'll get into it later, but sources speculate that he started over 1,400 fires. And that was going off his the diaries he kept that they found when they caught him, which 1,400 fires is a shit ton.
That's impressive. That's an impressive number of fires.
When he was young, his adoptive parents actually consulted more than one psychotherapist due to his misconduct, but it never really went anywhere. They kind of said, oh, well, it's not severe enough to lead to anything, so it is what it is. Get over it. When he was only 14, his adopted mother actually died from breast cancer, and his home life became very, very strained because he didn't really like his adopted father's new wife. It didn't really go into it or say why, which I'm kind of curious why he didn't like it.
Well, the article that I was just reading before we started said that he had like a kind of bizarre attachment to his adoptive mother. And so I don't think it was that he didn't like her specifically. I think it was that just no one was going to be as good as Pearl, because he loved Pearl so much that it didn't matter who Nathan married. It wasn't Pearl. So he was going to hate them.
Fair enough. So after attending Christopher Columbus High School, he graduated in 1971 and enrolled in college, which I don't believe he ever finished because he went on to join the United States Army. He served at Fort Knox and was actually sent to South Korea as an infantry soldier. He was honorably discharged in June of 1974, and this is when he located his birth mother Betty. After a few visits, she disclosed the details of his birth, which greatly disturbed Berkowitz, and he was distraught that his father never wanted him, never liked him. So that's something that stuck with him forever.
And also that his father was deceased when he found his birth mother. So it wasn't like he was ever able to go and reconcile anything or meet his father. He never got that opportunity. Met his mom, found out neither one of them wanted him, and kind of got to form a relationship with her, but never got that with his dad. So his communication with his birth mother kind of lapsed, but he remained in communication with his half-sister Rosalind for a time, then attended Bronx Community College for a year, enrolling in the spring of 1975, and then in 1976 went to work as a co-op city taxi company driver, and then subsequently had a few non-professional jobs, and then began working as a letter sorter at the United States Postal Service, which I find this to be really interesting, because I feel like if the psychotherapist had ever done anything, And if any of his petty crimes and larceny had ever been reported, he wouldn't have been able to get that job. Because there's a really significant background check to join.
Or been able to join the military and go through all that.
Right.
Yeah.
One thing we didn't say, in the military, he was known to be a spectacular marksman. So he was known to be a good shot, which makes sense because Son of Sam was a fantastic shot with a revolver. But that was one
thing. Well, when you're, you know, 3 feet away from somebody, I sure hope you could hit him. And then he failed at that. He shot the guy in the head.
There are some policemen on the workforce currently that are shooting people multiple times because they can't fucking hit them. So,
I mean, they always say shoot till they're dead. But I mean, if you're 3 feet away and they don't know you're there, you literally have a gun to their head and they still live. It's like, well, you failed another thing, Dave. Good job.
Poor Davey. Okay.
Fuck up a one car funeral. So during the mid 1970s, this is when Berkowitz started to commit violent crimes. His first attempt was actually a stabbing, which, big shocker, he failed. So not only can he not shoot people, he cannot stab people either.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, poor Dave. So he sought young female victims, and McKenna actually has more on that.
Yeah, so I was trying to figure out why Berkowitz went after young women, and specifically it was young women with wavy brown hair, to the point that once this hit the media, so many women started dyeing their hair and cutting their hair that, like, actually blonde bobs became very popular in the mid-1970s, nationwide, but specifically in New York. And I was trying to figure out why, and it looks like his adoptive mother, Pearl, had longish wavy brown hair. And so it would make sense that with the resentment that David was holding with his wah-wah pissy pants attitude, that he's going to go after women that look like his adoptive mother to take out this horrible life that he thinks he had.
Yeah. So at the end of 1975, on Christmas Eve, nonetheless, is when he committed his first attack. He took a hunting knife and stabbed two different women in Co-op City. One was a Hispanic woman who was never identified by police. However, the other one was only a 15-year-old sophomore in high school named Michelle Foreman, who he attacked on a bridge. And it was serious enough that she was hospitalized for 7 days. But Berkowitz was never suspected of these crimes. And soon he relocated to Yonkers, New York. So about 20 to 25 minutes from Co-op City. So far enough away that he's still close to it because he liked to go back and visit the crime scenes. But, you know, 25 minutes away in New York, you're not going to find the person. That's far enough away that you'll never find him.
Right. And because it was such a random attack, there was no way that they were going to, you know, link it back to him. And they didn't really do a successful job of linking any of the crimes together until really right at the end.
Yeah.
A lot of shootings happened before they were like, this looks similar. But so the first shooting, speaking of which, attributed to the Son of Sam, occurred in the Pelham Bay area of the Bronx on July 29th, 1976. So 7 months went between his first and second attacks, but this was when his MO really started. This was his first shooting. So 1:10 a.m. on July 29th, 1976, Donna Loria, she was an EMT, was 18, and her friend Jody Valenti, a nurse who was 19, were sitting in Valenti's double-parked Oldsmobile. They were talking about their evening, having a grand old time, and they noticed a man quickly approaching the car. Startled and angered, she said, "Now what is this?" And the man produced a pistol from a paper bag that he carried. He crouched, braced one elbow on his knee, aimed his weapon, and fired. Loria was struck by one bullet, and that killed her instantly. Valenti was shot in her thigh, and a third bullet missed both women. He got up, turned, walked away.
I love Valenti, that he didn't even run away. He walks away quickly.
Nice little speed walk, you know, normal, casual, don't mind me. Valenti survived her injury, but she didn't recognize the killer, described him as a white male in his 30s, fair complected, 5'8" tall, which, like, solid description, my dear, because he is 5'8" tall and weighing about 200 pounds, short, dark, curly hair in a quote mod style. This description was repeated by Loria's father, who claimed to have seen the man sitting in a yellow compact car parked nearby. Neighbors also gave corroborating reports. But again, this was random. Nobody knew who he was. He came out of nowhere, did the thing, left.
And, you know, walks away quickly. So just about 3 months after that, on October 23rd, 1976, a similar shooting occurred in a secluded residential area near Flushing, Queens. Carl DeNaro, a Citibank security guard who was only 20, and Rosemary Keenan, a Queens College student, 18, were sitting in Keenan's parked car when the window suddenly exploded. DeNaro said he felt like the car exploded, which obviously the window did, so he was close. Keenan quickly started the car and sped away for help. The panicked couple did not realize that somebody had been shooting at them, even though DeNaro was bleeding from a bullet wound to his head, which, like we said earlier, this guy gets shot and lives.
So cool.
Yeah, that's... he's a trooper. I'll give him that. Eventually, he had to get a metal plate to replace part of his skull, but neither victim saw the attacker here. And Keenan only had superficial injuries from the broken glass, which, if you've ever seen glass explode, you're going to have scratches and cuts. That's just how it works. From this attack, the police determined that the bullets embedded in the car were .44 caliber, but they're also so deformed that they thought it unlikely it could ever be linked to a particular weapon, which is back then okay. I mean, now you find a bullet, you can tell where it came from, what kind of gun they're.
Right. They're, I mean, I'm gonna say this is 76, so we're working with the 70s crime fighting here. That's rough. Yeah.
So this is kind of the weird thing. DeNaro, I believe, was one of the only males that he shot, because we all know, like McKenna said, he liked women with darker hair. He never really liked the guys. He didn't care. DeNaro had shoulder length hair, and police actually speculated the shooter had mistaken him for a woman, which a little bit funny. Keenan's father was actually a 20-year veteran police detective of the New York City Police Department. And that actually caused an intense investigation. Obviously a 20-year veteran and a son gets shot, there's going to be a bigger investigation than if it would have been just some random guy.
Right.
Because he has connections. That's how it works. As with the Laura Valenti shooter, there seemed to be not really, there are no motives, and they made very little progress in the case because they never saw the shooter. They really know nothing. All I know is the window exploded and they drove away fast. So they couldn't really do very much, and the shootings were never linked because they were in complete different places. So they're investigated by different people, different police precincts. So you can never link one with the other.
Which I think is also something super unique about like the 70s and 80s is that like, I don't know if it's different now, but I feel like just from the media and the way that things are publicized, it would have been easier now for us to put things together of like, huh, two random just shootings at a car, .44 caliber, maybe they're linked. Whereas like in the 70s, there wasn't like Facebook or anything where you saw every bit of news that happened everywhere that you don't care about to help them link that together. So
I kind of wish we could go back to the 70s.
Do you though?
I'm so tired of people on Facebook. Yeah.
Yeah. But like 70s and 80s, way more serial killers because they get away with it.
Well, I'm also not a young white woman, so I don't have to worry about serial killers.
Hi. And meanwhile, listeners, you don't know this. I am a young white woman that has long, dark hair. So, you know.
You know, maybe you should write him. Maybe he'd like you.
Oh, that's true. I should send him a picture. Aw, cute. No, thanks. Anyway. Next shooting. High school student Donna DeMasi, 16, and Joanne Lamino. They were, Joanne was a student at Martin Van Buren High School. Also, she was 18. Walking home from a movie soon after midnight on November 27th, 1976. This is, I think, the only one that happens outside of a car. I think all of his other victims are in vehicles.
Yes.
But these two were sitting on the porch of Lumino's home in Floral Park when a man dressed in military fatigues, who seemed to be in his early 20s, approached them and began to ask directions. just odd that he would even start a conversation, because he doesn't even get through asking the question of, can you tell me how to get, and quickly produces a revolver, shoots each of the victims once. They fall to the ground injured. He fires several more times, striking the apartment building before running away. So I guess I take back my earlier statement of Son of Sam was a great marksman because he was called one in the military, because he's not.
The fact they say this too, that he had a very high-pitched voice, is absolutely hilarious, because looking at this guy, he looks like somebody who would be in the mob in the 70s. Absolutely. Like your typical like Brooklyn mobster. And yeah, he has a like high voice. Eight, and he's just
220. Yeah. I wonder if he was trying to disguise his voice.
Yeah, because in the interviews, it didn't really... He doesn't have a high voice.
Yeah, it doesn't sound that high-pitched. So mafioso motherfucker, like lumbering up to them going, hi, can you tell me how to get to? And then
I would love to see him do that voice.
A neighbor who heard the gunshots and rushed out of the apartment saw a blonde man rush by gripping a pistol in his left hand. So that doesn't fit the description that was previously given of a brown-haired man. DeMasi had been shot in the neck. The wound was not life-threatening. Lamino was hit in the back and hospitalized and was ultimately rendered a paraplegic. So both of these people survived this attack.
So the next shooting was actually right about 2 months after that. At 12:40 a.m. on January 30th, 1977, Christine
Freund,
we'll go with Freund, and her fiance John Deal, who was a bartender, were sitting in Deal's car near the Forest Hills LIRR station in Queens, getting ready to drive to a dance hall after seeing the new Rocky movie. Three gunshots penetrated the car. In a panic, Deal drove away for help. He suffered minor superficial injuries, nothing big, obviously cuts and scratches. But Freund was shot twice and died several hours later at the hospital. Neither victim could describe their attacker once again. So he was really good at not being seen when he wanted to be. Obviously, with DeMasi and Lamino, you could see him. But
right.
So this is the first time the police made public acknowledgments that this shooting was similar to previous incidents and the crimes may be related. All the victims were struck with .44 caliber bullets, and all the shootings seemed to be targeting young women with dark black hair or long dark hair. A NYPD Sergeant Richard Conlon stated that police were leaning towards a connection with all these cases. Composite sketches were released of the long black haired Aurea Valenti shooter and the blonde Lamino DeMasi shooter. And they actually said that they're looking for multiple suspects, not just one. Obviously, having a black hair and a blonde hair, you'd think multiple people. Once again, they were wrong.
Right. Although this is a conspiracy that exists to this day. There are still people that think that there were multiple Son of Sam shooters.
Yes.
Which is really intriguing. And we'll get into the whole satanic panic thing later, because it's just a hoot and a holler.
Yes, it is.
All right. On March 8th, 1977 at 7:30 p.m., a Columbia University student, Voskarishian, was walking home from school when she was confronted by an armed man. She lived about a block away from where Christine Freund had been shot. In a desperate move to defend herself, she lifted her textbooks between herself and her killer to make like a makeshift shield, but the bullet struck her head and killed her.
So, just 2 days later, March 10th, 1977, NYPD officials and the New York City mayor had a press conference and declared the same .44 Bulldog revolver that fired the shots that killed Loria and Voskarishian. There we go. They claimed it was same gun. Official documents were later revealed, however, saying that the police strongly suspected the same .44 Bulldog had been used in the shootings, but evidence was actually inconclusive. So they think it is. They know it was a .44. That's all they know. So the crimes were discussed in the local media and on the news every single day, because this was, once they started linking them, they said, okay, there's clearly something here. Circulation increased dramatically for the New York Post and Daily News newspapers with graphic crime reporting and commentary. So obviously they wanted all the details out there, wanted to talk about it, you know, who did it, why'd he do it, everything.
And through the 70s, sorry, I'm going to interrupt. I don't know if you know this, but through the 70s and into, I think, the early 80s, newspapers were allowed and very frequently published graphic crime scene photos.
Yes.
Like graphic.
I wish they'd go back to it.
I do too, because I find it fascinating. I understand why they don't anymore. But a lot of these, the crime scene photos for these shootings were in the paper. So you could open up your Sunday morning newspaper and see pictures of people shot in their head in their car.
Who doesn't want that when they have their morning coffee?
I mean, it would wake you up, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't wake me up. I'd be like, oh, look, a shooting.
Oh, yay, another one.
After working in ER, nothing shocks me, nothing excites me anymore. It's like, oh, okay. So about 3 a.m. on April 17th, 1977, his shootings continue. Alexander Esau, a tow truck driver who was 20, and
Valentina Suriani.
Wonderful. An aspiring actress and model who was only 18 was sitting in Suriani's car near her Bronx home, only a few blocks from where the Loria Valenti shooting was. So they're slowly getting a smaller and smaller area that all these were shooting. Their thought for why this is, because David actually liked to go back to his previous crime scenes. It's something a lot of killers do. He's no exception. Suriani died at the scene, and Esau died in the hospital several hours later, once again without being able to describe his attackers. Police claim that the weapon used for the crime was the same ones that they'd suspected in the earlier shootings. So once again, they linked this one with the other ones.
So not to victim blame, but to victim blame just a little bit. These shootings were so widely published that they were even appearing in newspapers in Rome, in the Hebrew newspaper Mariv, and in the Soviet Union. So people around the world knew about these shootings and knew that they were occurring in this, like, cute little, I don't know what, 5 mile radius. Yeah,
of people always sitting in their car. So why the fuck would you sit in your car
in the middle of the night? So why would you sit in your car at 3 a.m.? Get out of your car, go into your house, sit inside your house in your living room and have a cute little conversation. Son of Sam won't get you inside. Like, don't sit on your porch. Don't sit in your car. Go inside somewhere. Stop sitting in your car at 3 a.m.
But I want to.
Well, now you're going to get shot. So, you know, do you really want to?
Hey, I don't have long hair and I'm not a woman. I'm free.
That's true. So this is where the attention whoring starts. So near the bodies of Esau and Suriani, police discovered the first Son of Sam letter. It was addressed to NYPD Captain Joseph Borelli. And with this letter, Berkowitz revealed the name Son of Sam for the first time. And obviously he'd been previously dubbed the 44 caliber killer, but since he called himself the Son of Sam, the press just glommed onto it. The letter expressed the killer's determination to continue his work and taunted police for their fruitless efforts to capture him. And this letter, A, is long and rambling,
yes,
but is disgustingly full of misspellings.
Yes. The final, so, I did like this final page of it, though.
Oh, I love it. But
it says, I say goodbye and goodnight. Please let me haunt you with these words. I'll be back. To be interpreted as bang, 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 years in murder, Mr. Monster.
Which is so cute, because he was like, my name's Son of Sam, but then I'm also going to sign off Mr. Monster.
Yeah.
So cute. I wonder if there's a little heart. I really hope that there was a little heart.
There wasn't.
Damn it. That'd be so cute. But I also really like the very first line that says, I'm deeply hurt by your calling me a Wemon. Wemon, a Wemon hater. I am not, but I am a monster. I'm the Son of Sam. I'm a little brat.
Yeah. And then he goes on how he says, you know, behind their house, there's the young people that are raped and slaughtered and their blood drained. It's like, okay, it's about the only interesting thing about this entire killer that there was. Compared to our other killers, that's about the only thing that is even remotely interesting about him. He's
right. So at the time, police speculated that the letter writer might be familiar with Scottish English, because there's a phrase that says Me Hoot It Hurts Sonny Boy, which was taken to be a Scottish accented version of My Heart It Hurts Sonny Boy. They hypothesized that the shooter blamed a dark-haired nurse for his father's death due to the too many heart attacks phrase that was used, and the fact that Loria was a medical technician and Valenti was studying to be a nurse. I think it was all just coincidence that we were near colleges that had a nursing course.
I'm with you there.
He didn't think about it that hard, and we know he didn't think about it that
hard. I don't think he was smart enough to think about it that hard.
I also don't think he stalked his victims enough for that. I think he went, ooh, pretty girl, shoot it. Like that, I think that was the level of thinking. The killer had an unusual attitude towards the police, and the media received widespread scrutiny. Psychologists observed that many serial killers gain gratification by eluding pursuers. Police released a psychological profile of their suspect on May 26, 1977, described as neurotic and probably suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, and believed himself to be a victim of demonic possession, which... Oy.
Yeah.
He knew he wasn't possessed. There's no Son of Sam. There is a cute little dog named Harvey. There is a very cute black lab named Harvey that did nothing wrong and was just being a sweet baby boy, but he was not a demon.
He wasn't, yeah. Supposedly he was a 6,000-year-old demon. And how we got Son of Sam is Harvey's owner was actually named Sam. Yeah. So the quote-unquote, the son of Sam was telling Richard to kill everybody. Real, real cute. They were right, though, saying that the serial killers like to gain gratification by eluding pursuers and observers, because that's actually how BTK got caught, because he sent a floppy disk that they were able to track back to the church that he was working for.
Love it.
Yeah. So, yeah. And same with Kemper. Kemper wouldn't have gotten caught, but he turned himself in, and they all thought it was a joke at first.
Too big. The ego just starts to get way too big, and they're like, I'm invincible. I can do all the things. I'm going to rub it in your face. And it's like, maybe don't.
At least Kemper, he wanted to be caught. He
did.
Yeah, we'll get into him next week.
Next week. Anyway, on May 30th, sorry, I'm so excited about Kemper, y'all. I hate Son of Sam so much. On May 30th, 1977, the Daily News columnist Jimmy Breslin got a personal letter from the Son of Sam. How delightful. It was postmarked early that same day in Inglewood, New Jersey. And on the reverse of the envelope, which was neatly handprinted, which is so off from the normal Son of Sam because his stuff is like scrawled and crazy, says, blood and family, darkness and death, absolute depravity, 44, as in like dot 44, like 44 caliber. And the inside is the inside of the letter is delightful. Hello from the gutters of NYC, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine, and blood. Cute.
Yum. That's what I want to think about.
And then the closing of that of this letter, it goes through a whole bunch of it's very, very drawn out. It's five lines of saying hello and a bunch of adjectives. And I'm dropping you a line to let you know that I appreciate your interest in those recent horrendous 44 killings. I read your column daily and find it quite informative. Tell me, Jim, what will you have for July 29th? And that was considered a threat later on because July 29th was the anniversary of the first 44 caliber shooting. But it goes on and on of, I love my work, I'm fantastic, blah, blah, blah. The end, upon my capture, I promise to buy all the guys working the case a new pair of shoes if I can get up the money, Son of Sam.
I wonder if they held him to that. Nice
guy.
Maybe I'll have to write him and ask him if everyone got their shoes.
Please do.
Well, even though he didn't write that letter. But, you know, we can still hope. So, not that far after that, there was actually, once again, another shooting. On June 26, 1977, Sal Lupo, who was a mechanics helper, who was only 20, and Judy Placido, a recent high school graduate, only 17, had left a discotheque in Bayside, Queens, and were sitting in Lupo's car right at about 3 a.m., once again, stop hanging out in cars at 3 a.m. Three gunshots blasted through the vehicle. Lupo was wounded in the right forearm, while Placido was shot in the right temple, shoulder, and the back of the neck. but both victims survived their injury. Lupo told police that the young couple had been discussing the Son of Sam case only moments before the shooting.
Which means they knew about the cases and they knew not to sit in their car at 3 a.m. Not victim blaming.
I'm victim blaming on this one. Straight up victim blaming. You know what? You get what you deserve. You know about it. Why the fuck would you sit in your car? Once again, neither Lupo nor Placido had seen their attacker, but two witnesses reported a tall, dark-haired man in a leisure suit fleeing from the area. One claimed to seen him leave in a car and even supplied a partial license plate number.
I love the idea of Berkowitz in a leisure suit. Cause again, 5'8", 220. Imagine just like a velour, like beautiful leisure tracksuit. Oh, cute. So cute.
With the stained white shirt underneath and his gut hanging out at 5'8". And he has the helium voice. It'd be wonderful.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, just that little bit of tummy hanging out underneath the zip up. Oh,
and the little mobster hat that they all wore. You got to have that.
Oh, God. So, with the first anniversary of the initial 44 caliber shootings approaching, the police established a task force, which is called the Omega Task Force. And they really tried to go through all the previous hunting grounds in Queens and the Bronx, but the next and final 44 shooting occurred in Brooklyn. And early on July 31st, 1977, Stacy Moskowitz, a secretary, and Robert Violante, a clothing store salesman, both 20, were in Violante's car, which was parked under a street light near a city park in the neighborhood of Bath Beach on their first date. What a bummer first date. They were kissing.
Could you say it was a killer first date?
That was such a bad dad joke, even for you. They were kissing when a man approached within 3 feet of the car. The passenger side of the car fired 4 rounds into the car, striking both victims in the head before escaping into the park. Violante lost his left eye. Moskowitz, the only blonde victim of Berkowitz, died from her injuries. That night, Detective John Felotico was awakened at home and told to report to the 10th Homicide Division at the 60th Precinct in Coney Island. He was given 2 weeks to solve the case. And if he did not solve the case in that time frame, it was going to be given to the Son of Sam Task Force.
Which I feel is pretty fair. I mean, yeah, 2 weeks is kind of short, but it's definitely something that if it's somewhat linked, let's send it to the task
force. Let's find the link and go to the task force, or if it's going to get solved separately, then great.
Exactly.
So a local resident named Cecilia Davis was walking her dog at the scene of the Moskowitz and Violante shooting, and she saw patrol officer Michael Cataneo, ticketing a car that was parked near a fire hydrant. Moments after the ticketing officer left, a young man walked past her from the area of the car and seemed to kind of study her. Davis felt concerned because he was wielding in his hand some kind of dark object. She ran home only to hear shots fired behind her in the street, but yet remained silent about this experience for 4 days until finally contacting the police, who were then able to look at every car that was ticketed that night and see maybe who this guy was.
Maybe we shouldn't have waited 4 fucking days.
Right? Like, if I get shot at in the street, I'm calling somebody, right then.
Yeah. So, Berkowitz's 1970 four-door yellow Ford Galaxy was among some of the cars that were investigated on that night. On August 9th, 1977, NYPD Detective James Justice telephoned Yonkers Police, asked him to schedule an interview with Berkowitz. The Yonkers Police dispatcher who took Justice's call was Wheat Carr, the daughter of Sam Carr, and sister of Berkowitz's alleged cult confederates, John and Michael Carr. And Sam Carr is actually the owner of the demonic dog.
Yes.
Yeah.
Harvey, the demonic dog.
It's kind of funny how it all kind of meshes together. So the next day...
It's also just leads more into that. It's like Berkowitz just telling a story.
Oh, yeah.
Like, well, of course my satanic cult members are the kids of my neighbor who is a demon and has a demonic dog.
Yeah. It sounds like just some bad, like, 90s sci-fi movie.
It sounds like he doesn't have any friends and they were the first names he could come up with.
Well, that too. So the next day, August 10th, 1977, the police investigated Berkowitz's car that was parked on the street outside his apartment. They saw a rifle in the back seat, searched the car, and found a duffel bag with ammunition, maps of the crime scene, and a threatening letter that was addressed to Inspector Timothy Dowd of the Omega Task Force. Police decided to wait for Berkowitz to leave the apartment rather than risk a violent encounter in the building's narrow hallway. They also waited to obtain a search warrant for the apartment, worried that their search might be challenged in court. Which, I'm sorry, if you have all that stuff in your car, I feel it's grounds for a warrant.
I feel like there's reasonable cause. However, in New York at this time, that rifle in the back seat was legal. So, really, they were going off gut, and they were already worried that the search of the car wasn't going to be admissible in court. So they already knew that they were on thin ice. So I think they were really worried that if they searched the car with really no reason, and then went in and searched his house without a warrant, that they were really going to be up a creek.
Yeah. So when Berkowitz exited the apartment about 10 p.m. that night, they still didn't have a warrant. So he went and entered his car. Detective John, I can't remember how you said his name.
Filotico.
Approached the driver's side of the car. Filotico pointed his gun close to Berkowitz's temple, while Detective Sergeant William Gardella pointed his gun from the passenger seat. A paper bag containing a .44 caliber Bulldog revolver, which was actually identified in ballistic tests, was found next to Berkowitz in the car. Berkowitz then stated flatly, "Well, you got me," which... they actually go on to kind of tell this, the conversation they had. "Now that I've got you, who have I got?" "You know," the man said in almost a sweet voice. "No, I don't. You tell me." The man turned head and said, "I'm Sam." The detective says, "You're Sam." "Sam who?" "Sam, David Berkowitz." Which really tells them absolutely fucking nothing.
Tells them nothing.
Yeah. Oh, you go by Sam.
You go by Sam. Your name is David Berkowitz. Solid. Yeah. But Detective John Filotico was officially credited by NYPD as the arresting officer of the Son of Sam. They then finally got their search warrant for the apartment. Searched apartment 7E and found it in disarray with, what do you know, satanic graffiti on the walls. They also found diaries that he had kept since he was 21 years old. 3 stenographers' notebooks, which I find it so funny. Robert Berdella, stenographer notebook. Son of Sam, stenographer notebook. We have a thing for these.
Yeah.
It's just legal pads, I realized, by the way. Yeah. Like, stenographer notebook makes it sound like fancy. It's a legal pad.
Yeah.
But they were nearly all full with his meticulously noted notes of hundreds of arsons that he claimed to have set throughout New York City. So I'm speculating that this number might be over 1,400. And I find this really funny. Soon after his arrest, the address of the building was changed from 35 Pine Street to 42 Pine Street in an attempt to end its notoriety. Which, sorry, what an inconvenience for every person that lives in that building.
They do this a lot. I know I live kind of weird near where Gacy lived. And the address of his house is not the same as it used to be. They tore down the house. They changed the address because people kept stealing. In that neighborhood, they have like bricks in the curb with the numbers. Well, people kept stealing them. Sure. So they changed it to another number finally, which that house actually sold not that long ago. I really wanted to buy it, but I refused to live in Cook County.
Oh God, I don't blame you.
Yeah. It was just like, not worth it.
So... after the arrest, Berkowitz was briefly held in Yonkers Police Station and then was transported directly to the 60th Precinct in Coney Island, where the task force was. I find this so funny. At 1 a.m., Mayor Abraham Beam arrived to see the suspect personally. They had a brief, wordless encounter, and then Beam announced to the media, "The people of the city of New York can rest easy because of the fact that the police have captured a man whom they believe to be the Son of Sam."
Yeah. I love that they don't even confirm it before they go out and tell everyone, "Oh, we think we have him."
Yeah. Rest easy tonight. We might have him.
So you can sit at your car at 3 a.m. It's all right.
No, you still shouldn't do that, guys. Don't do that. Don't sit in your car at 3 a.m. Go inside. If your date is lasting that long, just go inside. It's okay.
So Berkowitz was only interrogated for about 30 minutes on August 11th, 1977, in the early morning hours, and he quickly confessed to the shootings and expressed an interest in pleading guilty. The investigation was led by John Keenan, who took the confession. During questioning, Berkowitz claimed that his neighbor's dog was one of the reasons he killed, claiming that the dog demanded the blood of pretty young girls. He said that Sam, mentioned in the first letter, was his former neighbor, Sam Carr. Berkowitz claimed that Harvey, Carr's black Labrador retriever, was possessed by an ancient demon and that issued irresistible commands that Berkowitz must kill people. Yeah, so either you got to be a paranoid schizophrenic or you're a liar. Those are the only two ways I see a magical demon possessing a black lab.
Right, absolutely. But also, I find it so interesting that he felt the need to spin this tale, but then doesn't want to enter an insanity plea, just wants to plead guilty. And I'm like, sir, what was the point of spinning this tale if you could just say, yeah, I'm just a dick that shoots people, sorry.
Yeah, I just imagine like a little black lab puppy. Have you ever seen Little Nicky?
Yeah.
I just imagine Mr. Beefy's voice saying, hey, go kill him. We need the blood of pretty young girls.
God. So a few weeks after his arrest, Berkowitz was permitted to communicate with the press. And in a letter to the New York Post dated September 19th, 1977, Berkowitz alluded to his original story of demonic possession, but closed with a warning that has been interpreted by some investigators as an admission of criminal accomplices. So here we go with the conspiracy.
It was the dog. It says an accomplice.
There are other sons out there. God help the world. At a press conference in February 1979, however, Berkowitz declared that his previous claims of demonic possession were a hoax. No shit. That he had long contemplated murder to get revenge on a world that he felt had rejected and hurt him.
Oh, poor you. I wonder what happened to the dog.
So apparently he actually shot the dog on April 29th, but the dog survived.
Okay, well.
Yeah, so little Harvey survived getting shot because, again, Son of Sam apparently does not shoot to kill very well. He
can't kill humans, can't kill a dog.
Kill a dog. So from what I read, Harvey did get shot, but then he wound up living, and I doubt he's still alive. This was in the 70s, so
I would hope not. If that dog's alive, the dog would be like 50 years old.
He is possessed.
He really is 3,000 years old.
Still kicking. But I'm sure he died of adorable doggy old age.
Yeah. Or possession.
They performed an exorcism.
That was it. I knew it. So during the sentencing, he was actually examined by three different mental health professionals, and they all determined that he was competent to stand trial. Despite this, defense lawyers advised Berkowitz enter a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, which we all kind of knew he was going to. But Berkowitz refused. He appeared calm in court on May 1978, as he pled guilty to all the shootings. At a sentencing 2 weeks later, Berkowitz attempted to jump out the window of a seventh floor courtroom. After he was restrained by deputies, he repeatedly chanted Stacy, who was his last victim, was a whore and shouted, I'd kill her again, I'd kill them all again. The court ordered another psychiatric examination before sentencing could proceed. During this evaluation, Berkowitz drew a sketch of a jailed man surrounded by numerous walls, and at the bottom, he wrote, I am not well, not well at all. However, after all of this, he was still found competent to stand trial. I think they were worried that they would throw it out. He'd end up out of jail or out of, you know, a facility and get free. So.
But I think also, I think he is competent to stand trial.
Oh, yeah. He knew what he was doing.
I think he is just showboating and just putting on a show.
Yep.
So, and I do think that the psychiatric evaluation in this case was valid, and they were like, yeah, draw us a cute picture, but then also we're actually going to have a conversation. And he's not able to hold his like bullshit psychosis to actually answer the questions incorrectly enough to get the insanity call.
Yes. So on June 12th, 1978, Berkowitz was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison for each murder to be served consecutively, which means there is no chance he will ever get out. He was ordered then to serve time in the Attica Correctional Facility, which is actually one of New York's supermax prisons. And his prosecutors actually objected to it, claiming that his guilty plea should make him eligible for parole in 25 years, which actually went through because he's actually up for parole, well, now, but they're postponing it. So after his arrest, he was initially confined to a psych ward, which is kind of weird, seeing as they all claimed he was mentally fine and there was no reason to. But the staff actually reported that he seemed remarkably troubled by his new environment. On the day after his sentencing, he was taken first to Sing Sing Prison and then to the upstate Clinton Correctional Facility for psychiatric and physical examination. So I think that's where they kind of determined, yeah, you should probably go to the psych ward.
Right.
So 2 months were spent at the Central New York Psychiatric Center in Marcy before he was actually sent to the Attica prison. Berkowitz served about a decade in Attica until he was relocated to the Sullivan Correctional Facility in Fallsburg, and he remained there many years until he was transferred to the Shawanagunk Correctional Facility in Ulster County. And Berkowitz went on to describe his life as in Attica as a nightmare, which, if you do something like this, you kind of deserve to be in a nightmare the rest of your life.
Right, absolutely.
In 79, there was actually somebody who tried to kill Berkowitz. They slashed the left side of his neck from front to back, resulting in a wound that would require more than 50 stitches to close. However, like most inmates, he refused to identify his assailant and only claimed that he was grateful for the attack. It brought a sense of justice, or in Berkowitz's own word, the punishment I deserve. Well, no, you kind of deserve to die, but...
Right. I'm honestly wondering if that's why they didn't hold him, if he was, like, expressing, like, suicidal ideation, and if that's why maybe they held him in psych for as long as they did, and that would also explain, like, this kind of situation of, oh, yes, I deserve pain, I deserve to be hurt.
Yeah.
So, here we go to the fun part, kids. 1987, Berkowitz becomes an evangelical Christian in prison. According to his personal testimony, his moment of conversion occurred after reading Psalm 34:6 from a Bible given to him by a fellow inmate. I looked up, oh my goodness. Sorry, guys. DB's holding up his cute fat kitty and I got real distracted. According to his personal testimony, his moment of conversion occurred after reading Psalm 34:6. I looked up Psalm 34:6. This is the King James versions, the one first one that came up. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. Apparently, that was profound enough to convert him. So, he says...
Not the rest of the Bible. You can still kill people, and it's okay. Maybe, you know, the whole, yeah, thou shalt not kill their neighbor. Well, you kind of threw that out the window.
He lays over that one, but this psalm just, man, really, really got him. Just hit him real deep. And so he says that he is no longer to be referred to as the son of Sam, but the son of hope.
Yeah, maybe that's why he didn't respond to my letter, because I addressed it to the son of Sam.
Oh, that's not his name. His name is Son of Hope. Call him by his right name.
Okay.
Soon after his imprisonment, Berkowitz invited Malachi Martin, an exorcist, which can you just look up exorcist in the phone book? Is that a thing?
I guess. I mean, back in the 80s, it probably was.
True. Satanic panic. Everyone needed an exorcist for their kid that was smoking weed. So he contacted Malachi Martin, an exorcist, to help him compose an autobiography. The offer was not accepted. But during his later years, Berkowitz developed his memoirs with assistance from evangelical Christians. His statements were released as an interview video, Son of Hope, during 1998. And then more extensive work released in book form entitled Son of Hope, The Prison Journals of David Berkowitz. And that was released in 2006. He does not receive any royalties or profit from any sales of his works. He has continued to write essays on faith and repentance for Christian websites and has his own official website that is maintained on his behalf by a church group. He stays involved with prison ministry and regularly counsels troubled inmates. And then while in Sullivan facility, he pursued an education and graduated with honors from Sullivan Community College. I don't know in what. Were you able to find that?
No, I never, honestly, I didn't really look into it. Yeah.
Much. Sorry, guys.
So, due to New York state law, he is entitled to a parole hearing every 2 years, though he usually refuses to ask for his release and even skips the hearings. He knows he is probably never going to get out. Before his first parole hearing in 2002, he sent a letter to the New York governor demanding that it be canceled. He wrote, "In all honesty, I believe that I deserve to be in prison the rest of my life. I have, with God's help, long ago come to terms with my situation. I have accepted my punishment." Officials at Sullivan facility rejected his demand, so they still had the hearing because they have to. In 2016, he stated during his parole meeting that his parole was unrealistic and he felt that he had improved himself behind bars, adding, "I feel I am no risk whatsoever." His attorney noted that prison staff considered Berkowitz to be a model prisoners. However, commissioners still denied parole. 2018, once again, they denied his parole. The next hearing was supposed to be in May of 2020. However, like I said earlier, due to COVID, they've delayed his hearing until further notice, which kind of shocks me if they haven't been able to do it like Skype or Zoom. Or, right. That's what a lot of these places have been doing. Yet. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's my thing. And I don't want to say this is unfortunate, but I feel like because Berkowitz has so much notoriety and the Son of Sam is so well known, on that aspect alone, they'll never let him go.
No.
Imagine the headlines if they paroled the Son of Sam.
Yeah. Which
so, I, oh, God.
No, I got nothing. I mean, I know, like, when they released the quote-unquote Star Brock Killer, that was a whole debacle. And then, who was the other one they just released, like, 2 years ago? Andrew Coccarellis. Mm-hmm. Or, no, Andrew died. Thomas Coccarellis. They let out.
Coccarellis, yeah.
Which he actually lives, like, I don't know, 40 minutes from me. And they should have never let him out. That man is evil, and he's a fucking dick. I cannot stand him. He doesn't like me very much.
Again, though, like, none of these guys are going to be nice guys.
Believe it or not, some of them I've talked with are super nice. I mean, some of them were end up, found, they did find guilty, or they're, or find innocent, because there's some that I talked to that there's proof that they're innocent, but
No. Not the innocent guys. I'm not saying any of the innocent guys that you converse with are dicks. I'm talking people like Ed Kemper, probably a bit of a dick.
No, he's super nice.
Son of Sam, probably a bit of a dick. Like, they might be nice now,
but
kind of a dick, you know? I'm sure Robert Berdella was a total dick, you know? So, right.
So, in 2002, I found this one kind of funny. It was during the DC sniper attacks. Berkowitz actually wrote a 3-page letter to the sniper to tell him to stop hurting innocent people. I don't know where he gets the balls to tell them, hey, stop shooting people.
Hypocrisy, thy name is you.
Yeah, I got nothing on that one. It's like, all you did was shoot people and attempt to stab people. And you failed at that. So how can you tell somebody else not to do it?
Well, because the other guy was successful.
This is also true. In June of 2005, Berkowitz actually sued one of his previous attorneys for the misappropriation of a large number of letters, photographs, and other personal possessions. They didn't really go into that one a ton. I know that that attorney did self-publish a book called Dear David, and it's all the letters that he got from Berkowitz. And he stated that he would drop the lawsuit only if the attorney signed over all the money he made to the victims' families, which I can respect that a little bit.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't have much respect for the guy, but a little bit there. And they actually settled outside of court with the attorney agreeing to return the disputed items and donate part of his book profits to the New York State Crime Victims Board. So he didn't get all the way there, but they kind of met halfway. So it is what it is.
Good guy, David Berkowitz.
Yeah.
So here come the cult claims.
The wonderful satanic panic.
Oh, the satanic panic was like really a phenomenal time in our country. Like just so many good things came out of satanic panic for us now looking back. So in 1979, Berkowitz mailed a book about witchcraft to the police in North Dakota. And he'd underlined passages and written some marginal notes. Including the phrase, Arliss Perry, hunted, stalked, and slain, followed to California Stanford University. And the reference was to Arliss Perry, who was a 19-year-old North Dakota newlywed who'd been murdered at Stanford on October 12th in 1974. And her death and the notorious abuse of her corpse in a Christian chapel on campus was a widely reported case. And Berkowitz mentions the Perry attack in other letters, suggesting that he knew details of it from the perpetrator himself. The police, they interview him, but as of 2004, believed he had nothing new to offer. And that case actually has never been solved. It's now a cold case.
I thought it was solved.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'll be over here not knowing what I'm talking about. The Arliss theory has been solved. Who did it? Do we know? We do.
I got nothing.
You take over, I'm done.
So after his admission to the Sullivan prison, Berkowitz began to claim that he joined a satanic cult in the spring of 1975. In 1993, Berkowitz made these claims known when he announced to the press that he'd only killed three of the Son of Sam victims, Donna Luria, Alexander Isau, and Valentia Serrani. In his revised version of the events, Berkowitz said that the other shooters were involved, and that he only fired the gun in the first attack and the sixth attack. He said that he and several other cult members were involved in every incident by planning the events, providing early surveillance of the victims, and acting as lookouts, drivers, etc. at the crime scenes. Berkowitz stated that he could not divulge the names of most of his accomplices without putting his family directly at risk. Which is kind of funny, seeing as Berkowitz doesn't like his family.
Right.
His mom's dead, his stepmom's dead, he doesn't like his stepdad because of his stepmom, and he doesn't like his stepmom. So, who's he really going to put at risk?
Right.
Yeah.
So among these alleged unnamed associates was a female cult member whom he claims fired the gun at De Niro and Keenan, both of whom survived. Here's this fun part. I think he's like, oh yeah, all that crappy shooting, it wasn't me, it was a girl. Blame the girl. Girls are dumb. That's all this leads to. And so he says that the alleged accomplice was unfamiliar with the powerful recoil of a 44 Bulldog. So again, blaming the girl. She can't shoot a gun. He declared that at least five cult members were at the scene of the Froon Deal shooting, but the actual shooter was a prominent cult associate who had been brought in from outside New York with an unspecified motive, a cult member whom he identified only by his nickname, Manson 2.
I'm kind of curious if there actually was anybody else.
I really don't think there was.
I don't either.
I think the dog was a cop out for him just being a dick.
The dog made up all the names. I knew it.
And then I think saying that there were other people involved means that he wasn't the bad shot. Because the only ones that he claims to have done are the ones that the people actually died. He's like, oh yeah, I shot that one. The one that died, I did that one. All the other ones, it was the girl. The girl did it.
I love that two of the cult members he named, John and Michael Carr, who are actually the sons of the dog owner, Sam Carr. And both these people were long dead. John Carr was killed in a shooting that was judged a suicide in North Dakota in 78. And Michael Carr had been in a fatal car accident. Get it? Carr was in a car accident. In 1979. So both of them were dead. So you can't even go after him, even if it was true. So they didn't really do much with it. They're like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Journalist John Hockenberry says that even aside from the satanic cult claims, many officials doubted the single shooter theory, writing, what most don't know about the Son of Sam case is that from the beginning, not everyone bought the idea that Berkowitz acted alone. There's a lot of unresolved discrepancies in statements from witnesses and surviving victims indicate that Berkowitz didn't attack alone. There's three cars, five different descriptions, different heights, different shapes, different sizes of the perpetrator. So there's the belief of the satanic cult theory. You know, more than one person was involved, but they can't really prove the cult theory. And the conclusion rests on the criticism of Berkowitz's statement to police as totally false. There's this one incident with John Deal recollecting that he bumped into Berkowitz outside of the Wine Gallery restaurant as he and Christine Froon departed to his car, but that Berkowitz says that he passed within a few feet. Deal contends that he and Froon passed no one on their way to the car, and further that the placement of the car parked on the curb would have made it impossible for Berkowitz to have snuck up on them. So Deal thinks that someone other than Berkowitz shot them. It's very convoluted. I'm sorry. I don't remember who I pass when I'm walking out of a restaurant. I wouldn't remember. I wouldn't even focus on somebody long enough, even if I bumped into them. I'd say sorry and be along my way.
Yep.
So I understand that there's weird things in victim recounts, but also I'm sorry. If someone shoots at me, I'm not paying that close of attention. The fact that that one girl called him out as 5'8 and 200.
It was impressive.
Solid. I could not give them that same shit. There's no way.
So from prison, he actually kind of expanded on the whole claims of demonic possession. He stated in a series of 9 videos in 2015 that the voice he heard was that of Samhain, a druid devil, and the true origin of Son of Sam. He added that it was never a dog, saying that that detail is fabricated by the media. Which, if I remember right, I saw an interview that he said it, not the media. So
he definitely said it.
Yeah. So you don't know what this guy, you can't tell what's true and what's not because he lies about everything.
Right.
So even decades after his arrest, everybody seems to know the name Son of Sam because it's one of the most widely known serial killers. So I did find this a little weird. Sorry, I lost my place here. So the mother of Stacy, who he killed, actually forgave him for what he did, which, I'm sorry, if you kill my daughter, I'm not gonna be forgiving. It says, in a sad twist of fate, Moskowitz actually lost all her children at young age. One daughter who was 9 in a possible suicide, Stacy, who was shot, and Ricky, who died from scleroderma. Not entirely sure what that is, but at least I got the name right. And she had no survivors, and she actually died in 2006. So the fact that I'm still not entirely sure why she forgave him, they never really went into it. It makes no sense. I mean, you had all, you know, 2 of your kids die already at that point. Why would you forgive the man who killed one of them?
Right. I feel like it was likely a religious thing of, you know, she's carrying hatred in her heart and wants to be free of it before she goes to meet God at the pearly gates. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's just a bunch of bullshit.
like the Son of Sam.
Yeah, just like the Son of Sam.
So the one good thing that comes out of the Son of Sam is his legal impact. There was rampant speculation about publishers offering Berkowitz large sums of money for his story. And so the New York State legislature swiftly passed a new law that prevented convicted criminals and their relatives from making any financial profit from books, movies, or other enterprises related to the stories of their crimes. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down the so-called Son of Sam law because they felt that it violated First Amendment rights. But similar laws have been enacted in 41 states and at the federal level after it was revised in the following years. So that is one good thing. DB pointed out earlier that there are always ways around this.
Oh, yeah.
Criminals don't follow laws, as we know.
Yeah. Well, this one, it says, you know, prevents them or their families.
Right.
You have to have somebody not related to you and
trust them to siphon your money, which fair. But still there are ways around it, but it's so good that they put this into place because it's really dumb for criminals to make money off of the horrible things that they've done.
True that. And a lot of them do. And it's amazing especially after they die, the amount of money that goes for some of these things is unreal. Like when Manson died, the cost for anything related to Manson went up a ton. Or like Sam Little just died and all his stuff super expensive now.
Oh, of course. And so like glad that, you know, his family's not, I mean, I don't always think that it would be a bad thing for the killer's family to get money from them because like they didn't do anything wrong, but whatever.
I don't think the amount of money that would
have gotten siphoned into the Son of Sam, into like Berkowitz's account or into his family's account with all the royalties of all the things that are like in popular culture from him would have been astronomical. The royalties from the Spike Lee movie alone.
Yeah.
Would have been crazy stupid because in case you didn't know, there was a Spike Lee movie called The Summer of Sam, released in 1999, and the film depicts the tensions that develop in a Bronx neighborhood during the shootings, and Berkowitz's part is largely symbolic, but it's called Summer of Sam. It is literally a Son of Sam movie.
Yeah. Leave it to Spike Lee to do that.
Great.
Then obviously they portrayed him in Mindhunter, which if you guys haven't seen Mindhunter yet, absolutely watch it.
Binge it before next week because we're going to talk all about Ed Kemper. And yes, the actor who they got to play Ed Kemper, y'all, perfect. Is so perfect. It's like almost creepy.
Yes, he is. He does such a good job. He really was the perfect person for it. He had the height. He talked just like him. He did his work.
So good.
Yes.
So good.
So next week we'll cover Ed Kemper, who is the co-ed killer, and we'll be back to our regular horrible crimes and not such a boring one, because a little preview, he liked to cut the heads off people and fuck them.
Yes. So
that's what you guys get to look forward to next week.
Absolutely. So until then, don't sit in your cars at 3 a.m.
And
have a great week. Good. It's not 3 a.m. You're allowed.
Oh, thank you, Mom.